This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. We cover news and public issues affecting areas our students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel Liss. On today's show, we'll hear from a former employee of one of the tiny home villages around Los Angeles County. She worked at the Alexandria Park and Arroyo Seco villages, which at the time were both run by the nonprofit Hope the Mission. LASA provides oversight. That's the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. Our original story is available at lapublicpress.org under the Investigations tab. That's lapublicpress.org. The reporters of that story are me, Julie Patel Liss, and my colleagues, who are all but one Cal State LA graduates now. Marcos Franco, Tristan Longwell, Quinay Austin, Jonathan Chung, Brenda James Mirinjira, Sydney Wanguhu, Brian Antunes, and Emmanuel Villaruel. Our editor is Jenna Chandler. We plan to run a follow-up story next month based on newer information and our interviews. For now, we just want to share a snippet of one of those interviews to give you a sense of the conditions in the villages, as experienced by one recent employee. Her name is Christina Amesquita, and here's our conversation. I'm excited that you're here with me because you are someone who has really firsthand knowledge of the issues that we've been reporting on, and you can really give us an inside look of what's working, what's not working, what can be improved. So thank you again so much for joining us today. To start off, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about yourself, starting with your own childhood and how your own life experiences led you to the work that you've been doing.
I was born in Boyle Heights. I was born to teenage parents. I observed a lot of domestic violence, substance abuse. They were in and out of jail. I had to be raised by my grandmother because DCFS relocated me to live with them. And I later grew up and made some of the same mistakes in life. But then I realized that that was not the best way to live. And I had a daughter and I changed. I decided I was going to go to school. And so I focused on psychology, social justice, and substance abuse.
And when it comes to your professional experience, we'd love for you to share that because, you know, you bring so much to the table.
So I have worked for homeless services and underserved communities for 30 years. I have been doing this type of work since I was 19. When I started, I was only a few years older than the participants I helped. I worked for the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law, Catholic Charities, The Way In, 1736 Crisis Center, LAYN, Optimist Youth Home, Hathaway, Para los Niños, El Proyecto del Barrio, Volunteers of America, and lastly, Hope the Mission.
So you worked at two tiny home villages for Hope the Mission. What did you do at each, and what led you recently to leave?
The first tiny home village I worked at was Alexandria, and I left because I was offered another tiny home village location in Arroyo, which was 15 miles closer to my home. I was a substance abuse counselor at both locations. I left Arroyo because I just felt it was disgusting, unsafe. I didn't feel that I was able to do my job as a substance abuse counselor. How can I do my job if there's drugs everywhere, I'm reporting it, and nobody does anything about it?
About half of the 40-plus current and former residents we interviewed for the story said that staff members don't respond to their complaints or pleas for help, or they responded too late. 19 said that there are often drugs, alcohol, and or weapons inside the facilities, despite bans on all three. 19 reported water leaks, and 17 complained about access to restrooms. Did you, in your own experience, see any issues like this surface when you worked in those two tiny home villages?
I definitely did, and I also saw more. Staff did respond, but they didn't respond the way they should have. They responded by saying things like, "What do you want me to do about it?" or "What do you expect?" But the bottom line has been the same, which is they're not going to do anything about it. Nothing's going to change. As far as drugs go, methamphetamine, I saw all the time. I even saw them smoking it, like I'm walking by and I could smell it. So I'm writing an email saying I saw this and my word means nothing. Like sometimes I wouldn't even get a response. Again, remember, I'm the substance use disorder counselor. It is my job to address these matters. How can I address it if you're not supporting me? So weapons, I literally to this day have a couple axes in my house that I found because nobody would come and take it. Eventually I thought, well, I could get pulled over. This is going to look a little strange. I need to remove this from my car. As far as you mentioned the water leaks, during these rains that passed, I did observe the water go above where the foundation was, and it got into their tiny homes. And a lot of them told me that their clothes got moldy and that they had to throw it away. So I know that people will think, oh, well, don't they have laundry rooms? Well, they do. But if only two laundry machines work and you have 140 residents all with moldy clothes, that's not going to do anything. So a lot of them just opted to throw it out and just wear whatever they could find. As far as restrooms, I did have residents come to me, I'd say a couple times per week, complaining that the restrooms were not open. One time I walked out and I noticed that the residents looked very upset. And I asked them what's going on. And they said, there's no more toilet paper. They can't use the bathroom because there's no toilet paper. And an older woman even told me, she said, I asked them to open it and they are taking their time and I'm going to defecate on myself if they don't open it.
Most of the reporting from the story was from last year. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that even this time that there were some situations where people's clothes and belongings were ruined. Mm-hmm. So what we found in the story is also that more than half of residents, or 53%, ended up homeless when they left. Another 4.4% of residents, or 87 people, ended up in jail, prison, or juvie. And 33 people died in the villages, including 9 at Whitsett West and Arroyo Seco, which are both run by Hope the Mission, where you worked. In addition to that, the average length of stay that was reported during the one-year period of data that we had for the 12 villages was 153 days, which is obviously much longer than the 90 days that's often cited as the ideal time. That's basically the goal. What do you think is leading to these outcomes, and how can they be improved?
What is leading to these outcomes is being short-staffed, lack of training, hiring too many ex-felons, and let's keep in mind they get a tax break for doing this. Hiring staff requires money. Training requires money. Not hiring felons means the organization gets less money, but it also means they are ensuring the safety of the residents or the participants. As far as another, I don't know if everyone knows this, but the government has a model called Housing First. And so that means that if you're homeless, you're entitled to housing. And it also means that you do not have to improve yourself, stop doing drugs, take medication or if you're schizophrenic. So I think that needs to be eliminated. You shouldn't get housing if you can't take care of yourself. If your tiny home looks like your tent or worse, then why should we give you housing? Providers in the government are not really thinking of what's best long term. The way they interact with the residents leads them to believe that they're entitled to something. As humans, we appreciate something more when we have to work for it. Yes, it takes more discipline and it takes longer, but long term, that's what works. Instant gratification does not work. I would compare this to when you see a doctor that gives you medication all the time and sends you here and sends you there. He or she is maintaining their job security. When if they cured you, then you'd stop coming back. So I'm really saying treating them like humans, like being empathetic, listening, taking them seriously. Not once in the times that I've been there and the police came, did anyone ever take a police report from the participants. So if I assault a participant, nobody calls the police on me. But if a participant assaults me, they'll assault him and then take him away. So, and I did observe things like that. Lastly, I would like to say that all the parties involved, meaning government officials, providers, stakeholders, and participants, need to be held accountable. And I see the participants having the majority responsibility and leading the trajectory of their lives. And they need to realize that they have more power than they've been led to believe.
Right. And so are you saying that if they're staying in the tiny homes, there's no requirement that, you know, if they have a substance abuse problem, for instance, that there's no requirement that they go to rehab, or if they have an alcoholism problem, there's no requirement that they go to AA meetings? Is that what it is, or is there some?
That's absolutely what it says. Overall, providers are being very permissive. I think some of the people that Hope the Mission hired needed case management themselves. They just weren't ready. You know.
And that speaks to what you were talking about when it comes to providing training. How often are there trainings?
For me, as someone who worked in the mental health department, I can go to a training once a month. But for those like monitors, case managers, I don't believe that there's a requirement. It says it in the contract, but does it really happen? The answer is no. You know, maybe once in a while, 15 minutes on documentation, but like a formal training where everybody steps away for 4 hours, 8 hours, once every 3 months or whenever, it doesn't happen.
So there's basically one when they're getting onboarded, but that's pretty much it.
Correct.
Okay. And the one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we move on is, I know you were not quoted in our original story, but the participants, the residents, spoke glowingly about you because you were organizing meetings and that kind of thing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you were doing to try to provide some additional support services?
So Monday through Friday, I had an AA meeting over at the park. I called it a recovery meeting because I grouped all the addictions together. Other days we did facial self-care stuff, nails, hair. On other days we did karaoke. I would have speaker events once a month where we had, again, talk about addiction and recovery. And every 3 months, I had fentanyl overdose prevention courses. And then every 2 to 3 months, I would have the Los Angeles Department of Public Health come out and give a presentation on how to prevent sexually transmitted infections. Sometimes it was mental health, depression, anxiety, elder abuse. Those were not facilitated by me, but I definitely coordinated and documented all of it, make sure we had snacks.
What led you to do this? I mean, this was not part of your direct job description in terms of organizing all these events.
Because I think that the problem here is feeling isolated. Arroyo is literally in a little bowl. If you want to get out, you need to go up a hill, a very steep hill. So I thought, well, I can't take them there, but I can bring it to them, whatever it is. I even had the Los Angeles Public Library come out. That was great. I really like that because they bring arts and crafts. They gave them library cards. They didn't put up barriers to give them a library card. They made it happen.
And can you share with me just a sense of like the impact that you saw of doing this kind of thing in a tiny home village, offering programming like this?
They were more social. They communicated with me more often, whether it was through text or in person. Instead of going and getting into an argument with your neighbor about whatever it is, you're going to come to me and we're going to redirect and use words that are more appropriate to addressing your neighbor. And I would always remind them, like, when you leave here, this is important that you talk to your neighbor in a respectful manner. Please, thank you, excuse me, and that will work for you long term. I do feel like there was a reduction in substance abuse, but again, it's really difficult. I'm one person. There's 140 participants, each with layers and layers of substance abuse, trauma, health problems, and it is impossible for me to think that I can actually help everyone.
Absolutely. Can you give us a quick sense of how the tiny home villages are supposed to operate based on any guidelines you've seen or manuals you've given, and how some of those policies differ in practice, like what actually happens in practice, at least at the two villages you worked at?
So the tiny homes are supposed to be clean. They're not supposed to be perfect, but they should definitely be clean, which means there shouldn't be rotting food, maggots, buckets of urine, hoarding, pet feces. One resident found baby mice in her tiny home. Again, but she was a hoarder, so that's why this happened. But staff should be able to work with them on these issues, but they can't if they're understaffed. This goes back to funding and having enough staff. And there should be room searches. Room searches should be conducted, one, to make sure the participants are okay, and two, to make sure that these things are not happening. I was there a year and a half total, and I think I saw 3 to 4 room searches take place. And out of those 3 or 4, maybe 1 to 2 was done out of retribution for complaining about something.
Okay, and that kind of all dovetails well into one of my final questions, which is just that, what short-term and long-term changes would you recommend? You mentioned some of them.
Surveys are already in place. However, perhaps they should happen more often. And when the Department of Public Health or Environmental Health comes down, they need to also interview the participant. Not a participant that the provider selects because they like us or they're on good terms with us. Oh, show them your tiny home, and they show the one guy who has a clean tiny home. You know, they showcase him and make everyone believe that this is what every tiny home looks like on the inside. There needs to be audits, reviewing documentation. I have never been required to document harm reduction. I do it because I read the contract and I know what the mandate is, but it's never been mentioned at my meetings. What is harm reduction to these facilities? It's more work to correct someone, right, to redirect them. I also think the stakeholders, the providers, LAPD, DPSS, everyone needs to be a little kinder. I have filed for welfare, and I get treated like trash, you know. So if I get treated like that, and I look like I showered and can explain and have access to computers, imagine someone who comes in and is maybe not showered or has mental health and substance abuse issues. Does that make you feel like you can get a job? Does that make you feel empowered? Does that make you want to trust anyone? No, it doesn't.
Thank you for all the time you've spent with me, not just in this radio interview, but also when we talked on the phone.
Thank you. It's truly an honor. This is like a process for me to feel better, and I hope that it does have a positive impact.
One last thing. We actually have in our studio 2 special guests. We have Jade with us, Christina's daughter.
Woo-hoo!
And we have Eitan with us, my son. And I'm wondering if you two have any final thoughts. You've kind of listened to our conversation. You've both visited the tiny home villages, right? I know, Jade, you've been there with your mom,
yeah.
Or at least stayed in the car. And Eitan, last time when I had to go to a village to fact check some things. So yeah, is there anything that you would want to add about all of this in terms of just the conditions you've seen, what you'd like to see for the unhoused?
I really think that the issue of homeless people not being treated the way they should and getting the treatment that they should is rooted in, you know, corruption. If you just got somebody who is really passionate about their work, like my mom, you could have better outcomes and less people on the street.
That's very well said, Jade. Your mom must be very proud of you, and I can tell you're proud of her, so.
Yeah.
Eitan, any thoughts you have? Any hopes for the unhoused?
Well, when you interviewed one of the people, they seemed scared and didn't really want to say much, so maybe they weren't being treated good.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think a lot of times the residents that we interviewed were worried because they would be mistreated if they spoke up. And if an employee feels that they were fired or laid off because they spoke out, or a resident feels that they were, then they need to contact us right away, because it's really important at that point for us to do follow-ups and to highlight that. And there are whistleblower laws that protect those people. But anyway, thank you again,
thank you.
All 3 of you, so much.
A spokeswoman for Hope the Mission thanked us for our continued interest and politely declined to comment. Meanwhile, LASA provided a document that includes what contractors running the tiny home villages must provide and do for program participants, including how to deal with staffing, trainings, harm reduction, drugs, weapons, cleanliness, washers, dryers, restrooms, and toiletries like soap, shampoo, and toilet paper, and documentation for some of that. The spokesperson from LASA said, quote, on July 1st, the Arroyo Seco Tiny Homes Village transitioned to 5 key schools and programs. A service provider from the San Francisco Bay Area that's a new LASA contractor. As a new provider in our system, LASA will work with 5 key schools and programs to ensure they understand and adhere to the scope of the required services. This is Julie Patel-Liss for LA Public Press and UT Community News. You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. Coming up, what life is like for formerly incarcerated women when they return to their communities. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Vincent Mock. Every year, seniors at Cal State LA who are journalism majors come up with what we call capstone projects. They demonstrate all the skills that they've learned often, and these stories serve as examples to employers of the type of work they can do. Recent graduate Christy Ann Rios created a podcast called Beyond Bars: From Incarceration to Empowerment, with the stories about women who have served time and how they are navigating life after their release. First is episode 1, which introduces us to Susan Burton, founder of a New Way of Life Reentry Project. The organization helps newly released women with things like housing, case management, and pro bono legal services.
Welcome to Beyond Bars, Stories of Liberation. I'm your host, Christiane Rios. The podcast centers on the voices, stories, and resilience of women who have lived through incarceration and are now redefining, rebuilding, and reclaiming their lives on the outside. In each episode, we sit down with formerly incarcerated individuals, advocates, and community leaders to discuss the challenges women face, the systems they've navigated, and the dreams they're pursuing. This isn't about incarceration, it's about possibility, policy, and the power of second chances. Rather than defining formerly incarcerated women by their past convictions, we center on their growth and the powerful journeys they have taken since re-entering society. Our focus is on who they are becoming, not who they once were. Today, I'm honored to speak with someone whose work is changing lives nationwide, Susan Burton, author, activist, and founder of A New Way of Life. Susan has a nonprofit organization in Los Angeles that supports women transitioning back into society after incarceration. After spending years going in and out of prison, she made a life-changing decision, not just for herself, but for many others. In 1998, driven by an unwavering determination and lived experience, she founded A New Way of Life, a program born out of the very help she never received.
I started the organization off of money that I worked with and earned. I saw an opportunity to make my life at last useful. I worked 24 hours. You know, I slept in the house with the women. I didn't get a paycheck for over 5 years. I didn't have health insurance, but what I did have was meaning and purpose to my life.
Through housing, counseling, workforce development, and advocacy, A New Way of Life creates the healing and support network that so many women have never experienced. Susan believes in meeting each woman where she's at, literally as she walks out of the prison gates.
Our approach is unique because we meet a woman right where she's at. She walks out the gate. We have housing for her. We have social workers for her. We have workforce development when she's ready to go to work or go back to school. We ask, you know, what would you like to do? We don't ask, what have you done? We ask, how can we support you? If you want to go back to school, we'll help you get in school. If you want to go to work, you can work with our job developers. whatever it is that you want to do, we support you. We're not telling you what you have to do, what you must do with your life. We're asking you, what would you like to do with your life?
Susan didn't see challenges as obstacles. She saw them as fuel. The struggles of being formerly incarcerated and a poor Black woman navigating a system against her, she found strength in the struggles she faced and used it to build something transformative.
Seeing women who were voiceless be able to define themselves and gain their voice. I've seen women who have had no skill set, get skills, go back to work, get their children back. One of the women that was in our program is now running her own reentry house in Houston.
What drives Burton's vision is the deep sense of justice, possibility, and self-worth, and it's working. Over the years, Susan has helped hundreds of women rebuild their lives with dignity and hope.
I'm a Black woman. I was a poor Black woman, but I had the potential. Why didn't anyone, cultivate my potential?
Burton emphasized the need for more comprehensive support, including housing, social workers, and workforce development. Based on her experiences, women face barriers to reintegration that include a lack of healing opportunities and societal perceptions.
Why did I have to get stripped of my labor and my dignity? Why didn't the judge think enough about me?
Today, Susan is expanding her organization even further with plans to open new living reentry headquarters for women who are formerly incarcerated in Los Angeles. The need is still very urgent and the work is far from done. Statistics of formerly incarcerated women is often overlooked and hard to find. Despite the growing number of people impacted by incarceration, the data on formerly incarcerated individuals, especially women, remains outdated, incomplete, and often overlooked. Many national statistics fail to reflect the current realities of reentry, making it difficult to fully understand the scope of the challenges that these individuals face. Without accurate, up-to-date information, their needs remain underrepresented in policy decisions, funding priorities, and public discourse. Susan Burton's journey reminds us of the power of second chances and what can happen when someone believes in you. One of the many women inspired by this vision is Erica Orizaba. Erica shares her experience of living on the streets, facing danger, and being incarcerated. Erica has turned her life around. Today, she's living on her own, working and attending school, which is proof that healing and progress is possible with the right support. Before that, Erica was in survival mode, bouncing between jail, the streets, and addiction. She describes a terrifying moment that made her realize just how unsafe and unstable her life has become.
When I was probably sleeping in the tent, a girl, she came with a golf pole, and then she started following me around the alley and stuff, and I feel really unsafe because that's a freaking golf pole, That's not normal at all. She would have cracked my head open or something. I probably would have ended up at the hospital. Who knows,
Straight out of prison, Erica joined a program called FOTEB, which is a female offender treatment and employment program, a treatment center for women out of prison struggling with addiction. For Erica, it was more than just rehab. It was a reset.
I learned a lot of things, learned a lot of tools. I learned how to set boundaries. I learned how to be... To meet sober friends, and that's a big part for me because I never really had sober friends like that. I was probably in that program for a year, and then I paroled with my number. So I guess it kind of prepare you for so when you get to go to the real world, and the way you go about things with people, you're in an addict, and then just learning how to say no to people that you used to associate with. So they kind of prepare you with tools, so things won't happen in the wrong place and the wrong time.
However, the shift didn't happen overnight. Erica says when she was incarcerated, she wasn't thinking about changing, just about getting out and going back to what she knew. And what she knew was addiction.
When I was incarcerated, I wasn't even looking towards anything besides getting out and just going back to what I was good at.
It wasn't until tragedy hit close to home that everything changed.
My little brother had passed away from fentanyl. And I know they have that laced with everything now, so that's kind of what changed who I am now and the reason why I'm clean. So my little brother was like probably like a big impact in my life because he was like my little brother, you know, like I really did love him and I really didn't see him overdosing. Like he was never that guy, like that boy or anything like that. He's always been smart, you know, like loving. He never really gave me a problem. He probably passed away like 4 years ago, like on Christmas.
Her brother's death became the turning point, a moment of unimaginable loss that sparked a deeper calling to live. Now Erica is setting her sights on the future. She's working towards her high school diploma with dreams that go even further.
I'm probably going to go, after getting my diploma, I want to like get like a degree so I could like probably start counseling or like be a pharmacist.
Susan Burton's work and Erica's journey reminds us that healing takes time. It takes trust, support, and belief, but it's possible. If we want safer communities, we must invest in people, not prisons. We must believe in potential, not punishment. To learn more about Susan Burton's powerful work, visit her organization at anewwayoflife.org. And don't miss her inspiring memoir, Becoming Miss Burton, From Prison to Recovery to Leading the Fight for Incarcerated Women. Thanks for listening to Beyond Bars, Stories of Liberation. I'm your host, Christiane Rios. Tune into the next episode as we continue to explore the stories of strength, survival, and the power of second chances. Be sure to hit the follow button and subscribe to get notified about the newest episodes. Until next time, stay inspired, stay informed, and keep fighting for change.
You are listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour. I'm Vincent Mock. Next, more from Cal State LA graduate Christiane Rios. Beyond Bars podcast series, where formerly incarcerated women are telling their stories. Now we listen to episode 2, Still Moms.
Welcome to Beyond Bars, Stories of Liberation. I'm your host, Christiane Rios. The podcast centers on the voices, stories, and resilience of women who have lived through incarceration and are now redefining, rebuilding, and reclaiming their lives on the outside. In each episode, we sit down with formerly incarcerated individuals, advocates, and community leaders to discuss the challenges women face, the systems they've navigated, and the dreams they're pursuing. This isn't about incarceration. It's about possibility, policy, and the power of second chances. Each week, we step beyond the statistics and into real stories of struggling, healing, and hope. We sit down with women who've survived incarceration and are now rewriting the narrative, building careers, raising families, and advocating for justice and dignity. Not just for themselves, but for the countless others still inside. Rather than defining formerly incarcerated women by their past convictions, we center on their growth and the powerful journeys they have taken since re-entering society. Our focus is on who they are becoming, not who they once were. Today's episode focuses on what happens after release, the invisible hurdles, and the quiet heroism of re-entry. We'll explore the emotional and systematic challenges that follow incarceration, especially for mothers, women who must parent while navigating stigma, instability, and loss. Isabella Solomon was born and raised in Los Angeles, and she's still currently a resident. After serving her 27-month sentence, she faced a vast number of challenges reintegrating into society, from job applications to housing.
I think the hardest part would be just the stigma. Maybe, like, this is the only place since I've gotten out to where I don't really feel judged, to where it's like, I mean, when I first got out before working here, I applied everywhere. And it's like, oh, you're great. Oh, we love you. You'd be a great fit. And then, okay, well, we're just going to do the background check, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. Oh, you know, unfortunately, we're going with somebody else. And it's like, can you tell me why? Like, I mean, just yesterday, you're like, oh, my God, when can you start? Oh, because I have a felony.
Employment discrimination like this is far too common, making it almost impossible for returning citizens, especially women, to build balanced lives after prison. Isabella has now been home for over a year and is advocating for better support networks that make job opportunities and mental health care more accessible. Isabella also shares the deeply personal experience of being in postpartum while incarcerated, as well as the lack of medical care and dignity that came with it.
I was actually 3 months postpartum when I turned myself in. So I think that in itself, all the changes your body's going through to where you're already a mess, I was lactating, which again, I tried not to because I'm like, I know I'm going to prison, so why even try? But that's all he wanted. That's the only way I could feed him. So going in, I tried weaning him off a few weeks before. Horrible. No health care inside either.
Just let that sink in. Women are expected to navigate the trauma of incarceration while being pregnant, and more often than not, without the medical attention they may urgently need. Despite the odds, Isabella is reshaping her life. She's a full-time mom to 2 boys, aged 9 and 2. Her youngest child was born just months before she began serving her prison sentence. It was a painful separation that shaped much of her reentry journey while working, going to school, and advocating for change. Faced with impossible choices between survival and legality, Isabella made a desperate decision, one that is driven not by malice, but by a mother's determination to provide for her children, when she felt like there was no other option. Like so many women in poverty, she was caught up in a system that punished her struggles rather than addressing the root causes.
I wanted to be able to give them everything. Even though I was still working and still going to school, it wasn't enough. So I found an opportunity to where I could do more. I was trying to find an easy way to make ends meet, which honestly turned into the hardest decision I probably could have ever made.
And she's doing precisely that. Isabella is now working with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, a movement aimed to end mass incarceration and build a more equitable future for all. She is working amongst other activists on a bill that supports incarcerated mothers during pregnancy and postpartum recovery.
The first thing, which is actually like coming true pretty soon, was I wanted to be part of the group that worked on a bill. And it just so happens to be that this bill that I'm actually going to be giving my testimony for and like co-sponsoring is for a women's bill for women who are either pregnant or postpartum in prison, which is just ironic. So
the bill she is currently working on is titled AB 923. What it does is a pregnant or postpartum defendant would be allowed to submit a written request to the court asking to delay the start of their sentence. If granted, this stay would apply while the defendant is being held in county jail at any time during their pregnancy or postpartum recovery period. For more information on the bill, you can go to the Anti-Recidivism Coalition Program's website at antirecidivism.org. Like many survivors, Isabella has turned to creative expression as a way of therapy and part of her healing.
I never knew how much, like, how peaceful that made me, like painting and writing, drawing. And then also helping people.
According to the Prison Policy Initiative, women are more likely to be parents of minor children, 58%, more likely to be single parents, and more likely to have been living with their children prior to their imprisonment, making it more likely that incarceration would uproot their children and lead to termination of parental rights. Just like Isabella, Dawn Garcia is a mother, a student, and a community leader. She's preparing to transfer to a university from a community college with multiple acceptances in hand. Her story is both heartbreaking and deeply inspiring.
I currently have I have 6 kids total. 2 of my kids passed away. 1 of my kids passed away during 4 months into my 6-year term when I got sent to jail. And I was an addict for 20-something years.
in 2021, when my second son passed away, I realized that I had to do something different. So I enrolled myself back in school. I'm graduating in June.
In just a few weeks, Dawn will receive her associate's degree and begin the next chapter of her academic journey. She's officially transferring to Cal State LA, where she'll be studying sociology, a field that aligns directly to her lived experience and her passion for helping others.
Yes, so I currently go inside, back inside the prisons, and I share my story and I help facilitate groups and I just give other people that have been in the same shoes as me hope.
With compassion and courage, Dawn uses her story as a source of strength, not only for herself, but also for others navigating the same path, and her vision keeps growing.
Big hopes is I want to start my own nonprofit. So we're in the process of that, and we're in the process of creating our own curriculums.
Dawn wants to provide a safe space for individuals that may have nowhere to go for help by creating her own nonprofit organization. From surviving addiction and unimaginable loss to leading others towards healing, Dawn is living proof that it's never too late to make a change in your life.
Change is good. I know a lot of people are afraid of change, but change is good, and the world is so much brighter if you just do something you've never done before and just take that step of leap of faith and see what the world has to offer you.
Dawn's story reminds us that pain doesn't have to define us. It can only fuel us. Through courage, support, and a belief in what's possible, individuals can build a future they never thought they'd see. Deshauna Smith also carries the same spirit, a mother, a survivor, and a woman determined to break the cycle. Deshauna reflects on a past that was shaped by peer pressure, addiction, and the streets, a path that had led to incarceration and a deeply strained relationship with her daughter, who is now 21.
I had her at 15. I turned 16 the next month, and me and my daughter's relationship was kind of, you know, tragic because being that our age was so close, you know, and that I was running the streets so much.
Before prison, Deshauna believed that things between her and her daughter were good. That was until she heard the hard truth from her daughter's perspective.
Before I went to prison, me and my daughter's relationship was good. I thought it was good. But when I talked to her about it, she told me that it really wasn't too good because I was in and out of her life because I was running the streets and chasing gangs and, you know, using drugs and, you know, living the lifestyle that I wasn't supposed to live and not being there for her as a mother.
The regret weighed heavily on Deshauna, especially behind bars. However, that time away gave her clarity and a deepened desire to do better.
I wanted to be there for my daughter. So not being there for my daughter was very embarrassing for me. And, you know, it made me feel like, you know, I wanted to, after I got out of prison, I wanted to prove to her that, you know, I could make a better life for her.
She felt the need to grow from her mistakes, and Deshauna knew that she must lead by example, not just for herself, but for her daughter to choose a better path.
It showed me where I went wrong and where I didn't want to go back to, you know, and where I wanted to show my daughter not to go, you know, not to follow my footsteps, you know, to show her that education is a bigger, is the most important thing in life, and not chasing drugs and gangs and falling in friends and different things, you know, in the streets.
Her daughter was her biggest inspiration to push for change.
What inspired me was my daughter always telling me that she didn't want to be like me. So what inspired me was just to show her that I could do better.
Their stories aren't just powerful, they're urgent. They remind us that justice isn't just about time served. It's about the opportunity being restored, dignity protected, and voices heard. If you're moved by what you heard today, consider supporting organizations like the Anti-Recidivism Coalition and local reentry programs. Change doesn't happen in isolation or overnight. It happens when we show up, speak up, and stand together. Thanks for listening to Beyond Bars, Stories of Liberation. I'm your host, Christiane Rios. Tune into the next episode as we continue to explore the stories of strength, survival, and the power of second chances. Be sure to hit the follow button and subscribe to get notified about the newest episodes. Until next time, stay inspired, stay informed, and keep fighting for change.
You are listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. We are listening to a podcast series from Cal State LA graduate Christiane Rios, a journalist and activist. She's sharing the stories of women going from incarceration to empowerment from her Beyond Bars podcast series. The final episode is about two programs that can help women re-entry society after being locked up and put them on a better path.
Welcome to Beyond Bars, Stories of Liberation. I'm your host, Christiane Rios. The podcast centers on the voices, stories, and resilience of women who have lived through incarceration and are now redefining, rebuilding, and reclaiming their lives on the outside. Rather than defining formerly incarcerated women by their past convictions, we center on their growth and the powerful journeys they have taken since re-entering society. Our focus is on who they are becoming, not who they once were. In each episode, we sit down with formerly incarcerated individuals, advocates, and community leaders to discuss the challenges women face, the systems they've navigated, and the dreams they're pursuing. This isn't about incarceration, it's about possibility, policy, and the power of second chances. Today, we're exploring two powerful programs in California that help women and men heal and rebuild after incarceration: Project Rebound at California State University, Los Angeles, and the Anti-Recidivism Coalition based in Echo Park. Summer Stein, director of Project Rebound at Cal State LA, oversees the program that supports formerly incarcerated students by providing resources, mentorships, and a community of belonging. This is where staff and students gather to find connection and purpose. Despite her leadership role, Summer shared something deep: her struggle with imposter syndrome.
I didn't think I was right for the job. I did a couple of weeks in county jail for DUI. And that was it for me. You know, I just didn't think I was formally incarcerated enough for the job. So I was a little bit insecure in the beginning, but I think that ironically that kind of infused this brand of Project Rebound with a certain something special in that, you know, not that there's anything wrong with, you know, representing yourself as formally incarcerated. I think that's totally cool. Everybody should need to do what they need to do, right? And you definitely need advocates and people that are open about it. So it started out as the Formerly Incarcerated Populations Conference, and that was when I first – so I was a student here. I became a member kind of by accident. Then I was asked to come help the former coordinator, the original coordinator, and then he, you know, vacated his position suddenly, and then I was like, wait, hold on a second. I wasn't planning on being here, but here I am, and I love it. But the Rough Draft was like the sequel to that, so – I always felt like, as much as I loved being a part of that conference, it always kind of felt like, you know, it was a rehab counseling thing, and we appreciated that, but it was time for us to kind of take center stage when it has to do with our population, right?
Summer's journey began as a student at Cal State LA, back when Project Rebound was nothing more than a bare room with one computer on the floor. She's seen it evolve and has helped it become what it is today: a hub for individualized wraparound support.
Let me tell you that there's like no two stories that are like identical at all. Like, they're vastly different. I've never had anybody walk in that had a very similar story. So very individualized care is provided, right? Wraparound, holistic. We just reach out to our community. Whatever the need is, like I just told the young lady out there today who I've met for the first time, just come to us first. If you run into any hiccups, something's weird, something's not right, Before you go anywhere else, come here first and let's see what we can do.
Summer also shares how the program helps meet students' most immediate needs so they can focus on their education without the added stress of financial or logistical burdens, such as problems like money for books, transportation, and even housing.
So we can help with food. We work with the Village Cafe, and we'll get lunch tickets or take everybody out to lunch or provide on their ID cards, the ELO card. And what else? We do books, right? We'll buy your books. Mm-hmm. We'll do transportation. So if you need a bus pass or a parking pass, not both, we'll do one or the other. So little things to be able to help like that. So basic needs.
Project Rebound hosts community events like their beloved Intergalactic Return of Homecoming Prom, celebrating second chances with music, dancing, and joy. For more information on upcoming events, it will be on the Project Rebound website for students looking for support and for a way to get involved. During my visit, I met several inspiring women. Sharon Larson, a Project Rebound student, alumni, and advocate who now works at Pasadena City College supporting formerly incarcerated students.
I got clean in 2007. I went back to school. I went to Mount SAC. It took me 5 years to graduate, but I did it. And then I transferred from there to here. I met these wonderful people here. Because when I was in Mount SAC back in the day, they didn't have rising scholars. So I just kind of did it on my own. But when I got here, these guys, yeah, they walked me through. They gave me support. They gave me community. And I'm telling you, if it wouldn't be for these people, I wouldn't be where I'm at right now.
Now, Sharon is paying it forward.
I work at Pasadena City College where she's a student. I'm an advocate, and I do the same kind of work there that I do here. You know, just pave the way and let the students know that, hey, I did it and you can do it too. I'm here to pave the way, help you. And it's just, it's empowering to be able to give back.
Just across town in Echo Park, another force for change is making waves. The Anti-Recidivism Coalition, known as the ARC, their new offices are bright, welcoming, and full of energy. Everyone has a desk, and everyone has a purpose. Tariq Shipp, an advocacy and organizing associate, helps formerly incarcerated individuals find their voice in policy change.
I've mainly focused on getting formerly incarcerated individuals involved in advocacy, right, advocating for themselves and making it easy for them. So taking the complex bill language or laws or any of that and making it as simple as possible for someone who is just coming home so they can advocate for themselves.
ARC is grounded in community and policy change. One of its most dedicated team members is Cynthia Wong, a life coach whose personal story drives her passion.
So I grew up in South Central LA, and my father was not in the picture because he was always incarcerated. And my brothers follow suit. So just growing up, not having, you know, my brothers or my dad around because of their incarceration was like the main thing. But I was also married to someone who is still currently incarcerated, and he's serving an LWOP sentence. Really just be part of the movement, be part of the change, and assist those, because these resources weren't available, you know, back in the day how they are now. To those that are formerly incarcerated or even still currently incarcerated.
For those that are wondering what LWOP means, LWOP, it means life without parole. It's a sentence that means precisely that, no chance for release. Cynthia finds joy in helping people who once felt hopeless.
I would say meeting so many people from different walks of life, just their experience, their history, their personality, just getting to really know them and really being able to like provide them with the resources and the help that they need. And sometimes it's just like about being a listening ear. So it's really rewarding to just meet these individuals that at one point didn't think they had any hope, and just helping them navigate life, it's like really rewarding in itself. We train them here. We do have digital literacy workshops that help them navigate technology. And so a lot of them really like grasp onto it. They really like it.
Digital literacy workshops are a key component of the wide range of programs offered at the Anti-Recidivism Coalition.
These workshops are especially vital for individuals re-entering society after long periods of incarceration, equipping them with the essential skills to navigating today's digital world and supporting their transition into a new chapter of life. In addition to providing educational opportunities, ARC actively advocates for systematic change through policy reform. The organization continues to champion legislation aimed at improving outcomes for the formerly incarcerated and remains deeply engaged in advancing these efforts today. ARC is also working to change laws, pushing bills such as AB 923, the Women's Care Act, which supports pregnant and postpartum incarcerated individuals. AB 952, Youth Offender Program Fire Camp. The bill aims to make the Youth Offender Fire Camp eligibility pilot program permanent, ensuring that young people convicted of crimes before the age of 25 can continue accessing rehabilitative opportunities through supervised fire suppression, training, and valuable career pathways in firefighting. SB 672, the LWAP relief, which could directly impact Cynthia's husband. Cynthia offers powerful and inspiring words for those who have recently been released or in need of encouragement on their journey forward.
Honestly, be resilient. Push yourself because you're so capable of doing so much that you, if you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything you want, right? And always ask for help. I learned that a lot of times they're so institutionalized that they feel that they can't ask for help because they've been turned down their whole lives, even while incarcerated, right? So when they come out, it's hard for them to ask for help.
In today's episode, we saw the power of support, education, and second chances, whether it's in a college hallway or a grassroots office. The work being done at Project Rebound and ARC is changing lives, one story at a time. For more information about Project Rebound, please visit the Cal State LA website. To learn more about the Anti-Recidivism Coalition and its initiatives, visit www.antirecidivism.org. Be sure to follow Beyond Bars, Stories of Liberation, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review to help others find these stories. Until next time, stay inspired, stay informed, and keep fighting for change.
You've been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. This show provides news about issues affecting the undercover areas Cal State LA students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. That is all we have for now. Our executive producers are Professors Julie Patel-Liss and April Brown. Our hosts are Julie Patel-Liss and me, Vincent Mock. Music in Christiane Rio's Beyond Bar Stories is by Devin Ariano, and our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. Special thanks to our other Cal State LA faculty and staff, Christina Hackle, Tony Cox, Joanne Lyford Powell, Chanel Curry, Naheen Patel, Andrew Campa, Julian Reyes, Jane McKeever, Joseph Galagos, Elia Beltran, Jeff Fuss, and Jesus Cruz. I'm Vincent Monk from all of us at Cal State LA. Thank you for listening.